Hello and everyone, and welcome back to Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike. My name is Jeremiah.
My name is Mike.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
How you doing, buddy? I'm doing pretty well. You know, I am always surprised when it comes to Fargo about how funny of a show it is. I think it's being known for a very well-written show, a very heady show in a surprisingly mundane setting, as Varga is going to refer to later, but this is a great reminder of just the base level of humor that exists within the Fargo universe. I laughed several points during this episode, and, you know, while it may not have been as flashy as the first episode, we'll do an update of our death draft at the end, but I don't think we've seen any casualties so far, aside from poor Irv Blumpkin. I think that it furthered along the plot while at the same time really maintaining how solid of a show it is in its writing and its sense of humor.
Right, exactly. And I think the most important thing for me and you in this podcast is to make sure that we have the right chi, we have the right energy level to cover this particular episode, because that's important, I think, don't you think?
Yeah, you don't want any sort of blockage going on. You want to have the podcast Drano to be able to make that pathway nice and clear for any sort of business.
Absolutely. And I think we're there, man. I think we're there. I think we're ready to do this. As I said at the top of the show, this is Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike on the Jay and Jack Podcasting Network. This episode, we will be covering the second episode of Season 3 of Fargo, The Principle of Restricted Choices, directed by Michael Uppendahl. I believe I pronounced his name right. And, of course, this was written by Noah Hawley. Mike, what did you think about this episode overall, my friend? So it sounds like you definitely laughed a lot.
Yeah, I definitely laughed a lot. And that was nice because, again, I feel like it was not the most action-packed hour of Fargo. Fargo is not really necessarily known for its action scenes, but I feel like it's most remembered for those big moments. And we really didn't get any big moments outside of maybe Nikki's message to Emmett in his house in this episode. But we got a lot of furthering along with the plot. I think we saw a lot more into not only Emmett and Ray's relationship to each other, but also their respective relationships to their quote-unquote seconds in the form of Cy and Nikki, and how there's possible manipulation going on there. And Varga is slowly but surely moving in on this territory too. So the chess pieces are being moved further along, but despite maybe the connotation that a moving the pieces type of episode might be constituted as sort of a less interesting episode, I was still thoroughly entertained the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right. I mean, first of all, Fargo does a fantastic job with the comedic value that we've talked about many times before when discussing the show. That makes it for a nice pace of things, because you're right, Fargo is not one of those kind of shows where it's nonstop action. This is not Game of Thrones necessarily, or some of the other shows that many of us love to talk about. There's not this great dramatic scene, you know, every second of the show. It's more of developing the characters, moving along the narrative, and they always do that at a nice pace, which is great because, you know, as Noah Hawley said, you have to visualize this as a 10-hour movie. So, you know, there's only so much you can pack in for every hour, although they do their best to try to pack in as much as possible. And I think there's still enough here to make this episode very enjoyable to watch. That was a solid installment as well. So I really enjoyed it. It was really good, and we're going to have so much to talk about, of course, in this episode. Some things very gross to discuss, and some things not so gross, but we will get, of course, to much of that. I do want to bring up real quick on the title. I know we talked a little bit about it in our first episode about how a lot of these titles apparently will have some connections to the game of Bridge. Of course, we both know Ray and Nikki are huge fans of this particular game, especially competition Bridge. So apparently this particular rule, the Principles of Restricted Choices, states that a play of a particular card decreases the probability its player holds an equivalent card, which I thought was kind of interesting, because basically what we're saying is that, you know, if you're playing a round, right, and then the other players have played their highest card, you can assume that they don't have the other equivalent card in their hand, but maybe one of the other players does. So I thought that's kind of interesting to think about how that kind of plays in, you know, to our characters and how they're maybe playing each other and feeling each other out. What do you think about this? Any more feelings about these the choice that Noah Hawley's gone with to incorporate some of these laws or these rules or whatever when it comes to how to play the game of – they're not really, I guess, they're not rules, just principles that you can follow that kind of help you do well in the game of bridge. Any thoughts on that, Mike, about this this idea that they're doing with this season? Because it really does kind of tie in with the themes as well, doesn't it?
Or should we say Noah Hawley's restricted choice to make with those episode titles? yeah, I mean, taking this even from a literal perspective outside of the bridge connotation, there are a lot of characters whose choices are being very restricted. I mean, Varga is going to tell Emmett at the end, like, you can't change this deal. You're in for it until the end. I'm in control of you now. And even looking outside of that, you have Emmett and Ray try to look over their choices in trying to make peace, but they're sort of both turned away from that, and they're almost given another particular or restricted choice to essentially go to war against each other. So I think there are multiple meanings behind this term, just like with any sort of episode of Fargo. But I do like this ongoing thread of bridge. It stinks that Nikki and Ray's competitive bridge career is sort of put on pause, even though it seems like Nikki was all for it. She was definitely fine with sort of dropping this idea that they dropped an air conditioner on a guy and decides to continue forward. But I'm excited to explore more bridge roles. We're going to know so much about bridge by the end of the season.
I know we're going to be experts. You know, it's been a very short period of time late last week, kind of reading over bridge a little bit. It definitely sounds like a fascinating game. I actually do play a game that's not exactly the same way, but there was a game that I used to, an old card game used to play with my family called Canasta, that is not quite exactly the same game, but I think it's on the same level as far as like how long it's been around. It's an old game that I think only people in the Midwest play, since everyone else in the world really sticks to, you know, the typical card games like blackjack and poker. But it looks fascinating. I wouldn't mind learning how to play bridge. I think maybe I might take it up here as the end of this season comes around. Maybe I'll start learn how to play. Maybe I talk my wife into playing it.
Do you think Ennis Stussy played any bridge, considering that, you, as you said, it's only for old people in the Midwest?
Oh, of course. Yeah, he probably was a complete
bridge expert. Or was he too busy writing sci-fi novels?
Yeah, you're right. He probably was very busy writing sci-fi novels. Probably had enough time to play games. We're going to probably be – it sounds like we're going to be learning a lot more about Ennis's background, because we actually start the episode off with Gloria. Got this overhead shot, right, where she's unable to sleep, of course, because she keeps thinking about this murder. So she begins to go through all these books that she found in that hidden box in the floorboard. And she's really inspecting those books very carefully, I notice. And she even also comes across a newspaper article showing a author named Thaddeus Mobley, who had won a Golden Planet Award. And then, of course, eventually Donnie shows up, her partner, to come and get her because, you know, the new chief's in town and they need to get into the office to meet up with him. Now, really, Mike, when I looked through this particular scene, obviously there's a lot of focus on these books. I wrote down some of the titles, which we can share them here if we want to, of the ones I found. I don't know if you found more. I think the most important thing we're coming away with, correct me if wrong, probably the mystery of this Thaddeus Mobley, which we assume is, from what I could tell, is Enos's pen name, maybe, or maybe he used to actually have that name. I know a lot of people have been talking about it on Reddit. Some thoughts about this particular scene, anything that you really came away with in this investigation that we have going on when it comes to what is this guy? This thing is, he's really mysterious background as a science fiction writer, right?
Well, I just want to tell you, the entire time you've been saying that, I've just been slowly patting myself on the back. I think I took a complete shot in the dark by saying that Ennis was a sci-fi writer last week. So I was a little surprised that actually paid off. People listening to this podcast, do not expect my predictions to ever be correct after this. This was literally a one in a million chance, and so I lucked out in that regard. Yeah, I think this, the big question still is, as you mentioned, is Thaddeus Mobley a pen name, or is it a previous identity of Ennis's? Because I think one of the recurring themes of Fargo is this idea of mistaken identity, or people who are not what they say they are. And some people are very frank about who they are. Some people are not. You know, I feel like Oh, God, now I forget. Billy Bob Thornton's character. It's been a long day.
Oh,
Lorne Malvo. Lorne Malvo is a great example of someone who says, like, hey, I'm a dentist. Oh, wait, I'm not. I'm a psychopathic killer. You know, various identities is a great way of, like, masking who you truly are and your intentions in the world of Fargo. So there's definitely something to be sought after with that plot point, right? We have to put a pin in it. I don't have any thoughts right now. There are some titles that I found. Toronto Kane, Psychic Ranger, Organ Fish of Cluse Nine, right. The Plague Monkeys, A Quantum Mark, and the two ones that we saw last time. So Mr. Mobley seems like he's getting up there into like the Jim Grisham, Robert Ludlum type of number in terms of novels. I have no idea if they're any good, but it seems like I think we figured that with Ennis's death, it's going to be tied into the Maurice stuff, and that's how Gloria is going to be getting involved. But it seemed like Ennis has his own mystery as well that might, you know, throw Gloria off into her own yarn, separate from anything else that's going on with the other Stussies.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, to answer your question, I feel like they must have been somewhat good if he's winning an award, right? I mean, I guess.
And an award. But I mean, like, you know, how many movies does Woody Allen make? And he's won, what, like a few, only a handful of Academy Awards to show for it?
That's a very good point, my friend. So that was the biggest thing I have, is where exactly this investigation is going to pay off for us. Because my feeling is that, of course, me and you, you know, as an audience, we know that his murder really has nothing to do with his background. And the poor guy was just, you know, at the wrong place at the wrong time. It was a mistaken identity.
Quite literally the wrong place.
he really was in the wrong place. And so we know that her investigation into figuring out, you know, more about Thaddeus is not going to necessarily lead her to find out who killed him, murdered him. But the question is, I'm wondering, maybe could this have something to do with V.M. Varga? Maybe on something on that end. Like, by the time she gets done investigating, it's actually going to also lead to this organization he works for and their background. Like, I wonder if there's some tie-in with Thaddeus that maybe he was involved with them or something. There's got to be some kind of tie-in, or maybe something with our beautiful Berlin cold open to the premiere. Maybe there's some kind of connection there. There's got to be some kind of connection, and obviously we're kind of guessing at this point, but I do feel like it's going to pay off somewhere with this story, because, you know, at some point I feel that Gloria is going to obviously not only discover Ray's involvement with the murder, also, it probably will find out that, you know, Emmett and Sire have been involved with some bad business as well. So I think there could be this background check that she's trying to figure out more about him could lead to a lot more that she is not going to be expecting at first. What do you think?
And I think we should also mention at this point the character of Donnie as well, who's Gloria's partner. The role was supposed to be initially played by Jim Gaffigan, famous stand-up comic, but he had to drop out, I guess, due to scheduling difficulties. For some reason, I heard that was like, I don't think it was a last-minute announcement to the casting, obviously, since they filmed this a while ago, but it was a last-minute announcement to us. I think only like a week or so before the premiere did they say that he wouldn't be appearing. So now we have this guy, Mark Forward. The name Donnie rings true in a lot of the Coen brothers canon. The one thing that really sticks out to me is, of course, Steve Buscemi's character in The Big Lebowski, and specifically the quote from Walter Sobchak of, Donnie, you're out of your element. And this Donnie seems like that's par for the course. He seems a little out of his element, too, with police work. He seems a little sort of like, you know, our Bob Odenkirk in the first season, a little too nice of a police officer to be handling all this stuff.
Exactly. No, he does. And you could see, I was going to mention it, but during their very intense, not so intense necessary conversation with the old chief and the new chief, you could tell he was extremely uncomfortable. And that's very characteristic, too. You're right. A lot of characters that has been in the Coen Brothers franchise for sure. And of course, the names, borrowing the names. I like that. That's a very good point. I didn't even really think about that. I completely forgot. That's actually one of my favorite characters from that movie. I can't believe I forgot his name was Donnie, but no, great point. And we'll talk about it. There's actually some more connections. There's so many connections that they throw in that even myself, Mike, there's no way I can keep up with all of them. But that's why the internet is out there to help capture us. We've got a lot of smart people. Well,
I don't know.
There.
You gotta learn from Irv though, Jeremiah. Don't download too many things from the internet that says it's a Fargo theory, because for all you know, you could end up thrown over the side of a parking garage.
Yeah, and that could be very painful, I've heard. It really could really be painful. So now this next scene where we have we see Gloria and Donnie. Taking the car ride into town to go to the police station. We see that, again, we have Gloria. She's trying to call her ex, so Ron's, I believe that's who she's trying to call, right? And he's having trouble hearing her. So apparently, of course, she says this has a lot. And then, we move into the scene where they actually show up at the police station, which, by the way, is also the library, the town library. We have this other moment where the door... She's not recognized by the door. So thoughts about the whole phone, door thing, electronics. I wrote a bunch of things down here in my notes that we can maybe use that I thought maybe is going on. I think the big thing I was wondering is, what do you like? Do you like this idea about the fact that since she rejects technology, maybe the technology is rejecting her? But what do you think? What did you come up with?
Not to spoil the leftovers from this week too much, but this has really not been a good week for Carrie Coon with technology. No matter what day and age she may be, she's just... not able to work it. And I know as we're recording, we actually just got a tweet from Chris Arau about the idea of technology as well. And obviously, as you said, you have the runner with the automatic door now. I think it actually goes to a quote that Varga is going to say in the very last scene about why he feels that Emmett's parking lot company is the perfect place to launder money. And he gives a few reasons, one of them being that it's doesn't use technology. It makes income basically impossible to verify in that regard. And I think that even outside of Gloria, this Eden Valley, Eden Prairie townships are essentially in stasis technology-wise. I think there are some people that do utilize technology. You know, you're going to have the new chief later on say, like, this is the future. Why the hell aren't you using computers? But it seems like our main characters are not really, maybe outside of like Ray on his phone a couple times, are not really diving into the wonders that come with the internet and social media that much. They're really relying on these archaic, old school methods of, you know, doing things freehand and figuring things out through intuition. And sometimes it's to disguise things. Sometimes it's just a way to figure things out without relying necessarily on technology. But I think it's something to look out for, because it is pretty alarming, even outside of the cell reception and automatic door stuff, for people to not be so good on the internet in the year 2010. I could totally understand if it was like 2002 or even the late 90s when the internet was first becoming a thing. But I think this is definitely representative of, again, Varga is going to talk about later on, the reason why he likes Minnesota is because it's so perfectly, sublimely bland. It's almost in its own bubble, separated from the rest of the cruel world, where everyone is smiling and happy, but it doesn't seem like they've done anything or improved on anything outside of the year 1978.
Yeah, exactly. And then moving right into the next scene is a great example, like you said, about that, because we have Emmett and Cy, of course, having this meeting with their lawyer, Bumpkin, which we talked about just a second ago, and how, you know, of course, they want him to investigate VM Vargo, which, by the way, I love the fact that he gives them a hard time about borrowing money to a guy they don't even know what his first name is, which is pretty funny. But yeah, that example again right there, another example where this guy, like you said, he doesn't even seem to know how to use the internet. I mean, who doesn't know that you hit enter after you put the name?
Yeah, it says it on the key. Why would you, like, I don't know if that's internet aptitude or if that might be Irv Blumkin getting up there in the ages, considering that his secretary, who looked to be around the same age as him, was able to do that fairly easily.
Yeah, she goes, oh, he hit enter. And he's like, what? Where? I was like,
What's enter?
I know, I'm watching this scene, I'm laughing my ass out because I'm just like going, oh my gosh. And then, of course, you know, he downloads the... whatever that link was, that then, of course, it brings up the camera, takes their picture, and then completely shuts their system down, apparently, which was great, you know? And it was such a fantastic scene. But yeah, this constant thing about the technology, it's a big part of it. I think Noah has, I think he had a few articles talking about that. We were touching a little bit even more on technology, because you think about the three seasons we had collectively of Fargo. Obviously, the first season was in 2006, you know, technology not too far from where we're at now in 2010. Now, of course, the 70s, where we had very little technology compared to what we have today. So very interesting look into that. But I think one of the things I kind of take away from the fact that we have also this overall thing about issues with communication. It doesn't matter how much technology we have. People still get their communications messed up, which we see a lot of that in this season of Fargo and even in seasons in past. So, yeah, right. We should definitely pay attention to this, because Noah Hawley's definitely telling us something here with all this references to technology. And we haven't even touched on, there's a few other places in this episode where there's some kind of mention of technology or an issue with technology. So very fascinating.
And I think that also, speaking in outside of the technological aspects about the fact that Gloria just wasn't able to make a phone call, might be more representative of the fact that it seems like she has trouble communicating with anyone. I know I sort of have hoisted this Marge Gunderson, Molly Salverson analog onto her of, I predict that Gloria is going to go into this investigation and Mr. Hardass, new chief, is going to be like, what are you doing? I don't understand why you're doing this. You're making no sense, when she's really on the right track. So that could be another representative type of moment where, you know, she's trying to talk to people, but for some reason the reception isn't coming through and people aren't listening.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I did kind of skip over the scene, by the way, where we see Emmett and Cy driving back. Emmett, of course, has this moment where he's talking about how maybe he was being too hard on his brother. But one of the big things I took away from this was Cy was immediately kind of like saying, you know, well, your brother's basically an idiot, you know, and he's like trying, you know, of course, Emmett's like, well, my brother's not an idiot and all that stuff. What I really took away from this very early on, I think we picked up on in the first episode as well, is that he really doesn't like Ray whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like, he seems to really hate him, right? Did you really picking that up, especially in this episode, more and more so, that he wants to be rid of his brother. Now, I don't know if it's just because that Emmett and Cy seem to have this very unusually tight, close relationship. Like, Emmett almost kind of, or Cy almost kind of, like, is almost obsessed with Emmett. Like, he looks at him so highly. He like brags about him. He reminds him again in this scene in the car, like, you're the parking lot king of Minnesota, you know? You know, he's really infatuated with this guy. And I think that he would like to just eliminate almost anybody in Emmett's life except for him. It just kind of feels that way. Is that, were you picking up the same thing when you're watching this scene?
So I know we talked last week about this fact that, like, oh, obviously Nikki is manipulating Ray. It's clear that she really has ulterior motives in mind. I did not expect the same relationship to come out of Emmett and Cy as well. At least from the first episode, I think Cy does hold a certain amount of leverage, saying that, like, I'm the lawyer. He throws that around in terms of this episode, like, plausible deniability that clearly Emmett doesn't really know about. But I was surprised in this scene that Cy was really able to warp his words correctly to be able to really get Emmett back on his side. Maybe we'll see some sort of flashback, because obviously we know a little bit about maybe the fallout between the brothers, but maybe Cy's involved in there as well. Maybe one of the reasons why, as you said, Cy doesn't want Ray in there is because Cy wants to consistently be his number two. But yeah, there's a definite difference between him sort of giving the reasoning of Ray's going to give in, if you give Ray an inch, he'll take a mile, and calling him a flat-out loser. But I will say, I think in my opinion, Cy was the MVP of this episode. You know, I'm sort of have to like root for his death since he's part of my death draft, but he was just so freaking funny, and also has like a little bit of a callous side to him as well. We saw so much more of Cy in the second episode than I thought we would upon first glance.
A lot. He's a big player in this season, obviously, and I love watching him. He's so great. And this episode, you're right, really highlighted so much of him that I really enjoy every time he's involved in anything that's going on. So yeah, I lot to talk about, and I'll mention a little bit more here a little bit later on. I got this thing I want to talk to you a little bit about him, and how he kind of relates with Nikki and how he plays with the brothers. And I'll talk about that in a second. But so we had the next couple of scenes after we had the scene with where we see that Irv obviously struggles to search our friend VM, which, by the way, he only wants us to call him VM. We did see...
that's another gray moment as well. I know I keep alluding to moments from the last scene of the episode, but you know, for Irv to say like, "Oh yeah, you got to know his first name," and then you know, say like, "Okay, Mr. Varga, let us know your first name." He's like, "Oh please, call me VM." The fact that he's sort of spreading this odious facade of familiarity by being like, "Oh no, call me by my first name," but even then, his first name is still really not a first name. He's still masking what VM stands for. It's very indicative of the one-sided relationship that Varga has with these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, him and his crew, of course, show up at one of Stussy's parking lots, the Oak Bridge lot, by the way, with this gigantic semi truck, which they call the Big Rig, and he has this just amazing. I just love the scene with the parking lot attendant. That guy, he was not prepared to meet the embargo whatsoever, and
or learn the definition of the word surmise. Who knew he would be in for a vocab lesson?
The guy didn't even seem like he even knew who he worked for. So I love the part where VM's like, "We're done here. Just keep on going."
Yeah, it's clear that Varga does a great job of just, like, sizing up his competition and really just throwing around his machismo wherever he goes to be like, "Oh, yeah, I'm above you. I don't really need to deal with you right now." And the parking lot attendant is a great example of that, where he can just sort of drive in, confuse the heck out of him, and be like, "Oh, no, I'm important. Let's keep going." And this is where we also get the first glance at Varga's two lackeys, which we will definitely talk some more about once one of their identities specifically is revealed later on.
Absolutely. So yeah, it was a great scene, and I just love watching this guy work. And you know, there's so much discussion about card play. I think VM Varga would be a pretty good card player. He, like you said, he could really sum somebody up very quickly, and I think he would he'd handle himself pretty well, I think, playing cards, don't you think?
I would definitely think so. I put my money on him in the World Series of Poker.
Right. So then we see, of course, later on, we see a scene where Sai, of course, informs Emmett about VM showing up with this truck. They wonder what might be in the truck, and Sai wants to, of course, leave things alone for a while to see if Irv can come up with some dirt on VM. But let's talk about their... They talk about what they think could possibly be in this truck, and the fact that Sai thinks it's slave girls... I think it was, it might have been, who did I read maybe a comment about? Was it Alan? Maybe it was. But anyway, somebody had read about it. They said, "Wow, I would wonder what kind of things you would find in Sai's, if you were to search Sai's computer and see his history and his internet searches, what would come up? I think something about slave girls might be in there. What do you think?"
Yeah, or he just finished watching The Wire season 2. Either or, because yeah, that was such a great introspection into Sai's character, where it's like, you know, I don't even want to say it out loud. And Sai's initial thought was, "Oh God, slave girls!" Like, just again, such a great comedic scene, such great work from two of them. They actually play really well off each other. So again, while I am praying for Sai's eventual death, I want to continue to see him play off of Emmett, because the guy has just turned out to be such a whack job.
Right, exactly. definitely a whack job. The only other thing we kind of this, there was a mention about Stan Grossman, which apparently, of course, was a character from the movie. I almost forgot about that name. He was Jerry's father-in-law's right-hand man. And people were talking about the comparisons between Jerry's father-in-law and this Stan, how their relationship kind of parallels very similar to Emmett and Sai, which that was a nice pickup. I think I saw somebody talking about that on Reddit. And very, very true. And it's a nice tie. We see so many of these little ones that come up, but apparently, you know, they had mentioned his name because of involvement in, you know, the parking lot business. So that was very fascinating. Any takeaway from that? I mean,
yes, it's not as prevalent of a connection as, you know, Oliver Platt's character of, "Hey, I buried, you know, I found some money that was buried in the snow with a ice picker stuck in it," which is directly from the movie. But I think those little tastes of it are nice little Easter eggs for us Coen heads to really delight in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are characters that, I mean, this world is supposed to be all connected in a way that you know, from the movies and stuff, from the movie. So we actually, you know, to use his name, I mean, it makes sense that his name would still be around, because, you know, he wasn't someone that was involved in any of the shenanigans that happens in the film, not to spoil anything too much. About the movie Fargo, but I love those little things, and I when I heard the name, I it sounded familiar, but of course I had to look it up, and of course people were talking about it, which was great. Now the next scene, I already kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, but we have the scene where we have Gloria and Donnie are having their big meeting with the new chief. And of course he's not very happy, you know, with his surroundings, you know, noticing that this, they don't even have a place for their prisoners. There's no computers. They're using extremely old technology. This meeting, of course, is not going very well. Gloria is not happy whatsoever. She eventually leaves at some point after kind of insulting the new chief a little bit, because she wants to, of course, go and interview the gas station attendant who apparently, of course, may have seen Maurice right before the murder. More technology talk, right? And as far as like old, new, things like that. But, you know, we kind of covered the scene a little bit already. But was there any other thoughts that came out of this particular scene?
Well, we did get the introduction to Shay Wickham as this new chief, as Chief Mo Damick. Jeremiah, as our resident Boardwalk Empire expert on the panel here, do you like his introduction here? Were you a fan of Shay coming into this show?
Yeah, actually, I am a fan of Shay. I really enjoyed his work on Boardwalk Empire. And I think this feels to me like a perfect role for him, right? I mean, I don't know if... Did you see Boardwalk Empire? I can't remember if you watched
No, I haven't seen Boardwalk Empire. What I recognize Shay Wickham from is he played a role in two of the Fast and the Furious movies where Paul Walker pretty much punched him in the face both times. So that's what I personally remember him from. So if he's playing this sort of hard-ass man in charge, then I think this is the role he was born to play.
Perfect description, by the way. That's him in a nutshell. He really captures the hard-ass very well. And of course, this particular new chief, Mo, is it, which said his name was, is that exactly to the T. I mean, he's definitely a bit of a hard ass. But you know, the funny thing is, I can't help but kind of agree with the guy. You know, I mean, you know, I know they're in a small town. It's nothing seems to ever happen. But man, oh man, you got to call another department in another town to get information about people. I mean, it feels like they could at least update some things, right?
Yeah, well, and also it's an interesting comparison to what's going on with Varga. I feel like in both cases, it's, again, this serene bubble of this Minnesotan area that's being pricked by these pricks coming in and essentially, you know, taking over their business of operations and saying, you know, this is how you're supposed to be doing things. This is how we do things in the real world. So even though, you know, VM Varga might be more smooth in that regard, I feel like Mo sort of has that outsider status as well.
Yeah, very, very true. Absolutely. So, yeah, that's a good point. Now, the next scene, we do get to see, of course, Gloria interview this Earl who runs this gas station. I'm assuming he's one of the guests. Or maybe he just happened to be an attendant. Do you feel like he maybe actually ran that gas station? Did you pick up on that?
I don't want to stereotype the Midwest, but I feel like it's one of those places where, like, you have a guy who runs that lowly gas station who he might be working the late shift. Maybe there's someone else to take over, but it seems like Earl spends a good majority of the time staffing that gas station.
Yeah, I feel that way as well. So he's, of course, talking about his run-in with Maurice, which I thought was funny because he felt like he was Russian. He even said, well, I think he may have told me that, but he didn't know why he thought he was Russian, but he thought he was Russian. He talks about how he wanted some orange juice from concentrate and asked Gloria, can't you make meth from that? So they clearly try to make this character seem a little dense, which kind of follows the theme for a lot of the characters in Marco. So many of them seem dense. Sometimes I do feel like Noah Hawley, and I guess it's kind of is part of the joke, may shall you say, how they kind of really do seem to dumb down so many people from this part of the world. So like, if I really was from Minnesota, I think I would be insulted at times watching this, where it just seems like everyone seems very dumb. She interviews him, and of course I pretty much takes the phone book, which he was seemed to be very upset about that as well. But yeah, you were going to say something about the level of people, characters from this show, and their level of intelligence.
Yeah, Earl, first of all, poor Earl, you know, first he gets a page from his phone book stolen, now his entire phone book gets stolen, this poor man. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if I want to talk too much about the characterization, because yeah, I think him and Donnie are clearly kind of in this broad brush that Fargo likes to paint with sometimes, make these characters more two-dimensional, which I think sort of is in balance with the fact that their main characters are such wonderful three-dimensional portraits that it's almost almost makes up for it, in my opinion. I don't feel like, you know, these characters are too Flanderized, that these characters are too stupid, especially if they're just one-offs. But yeah, Earl, poor Earl, he's like Kevin from The Office. He doesn't even realize what the word singular means. I think that poor Earl might have gotten a few brain cells knocked out of his head by Maurice after he didn't give up the phone book.
Yeah, exactly. No, I like that. You're right. They counterbalance each other when you have a character that's a lot lower level, shall we say, than the others. And it does kind of help out the character development of the ones that we do care about. But you're right. I like that. And it makes a lot of sense. But yeah, poor Earl. He really had a rough go around there with the phone book. He seemed like he really loves that phone book, too. He had a lot of attachment to it and felt like that this was a terrible thing, that they will no longer have it available for their customers to come in. Because I'm sure people are wanting it all the time.
Absolutely. I think that's the number one reason why you go to a gas station, right? Is to look at the phone book.
Yeah, of course. Who doesn't, right? Mike, I'm hoping you can help me a little bit with this next scene, because Ray, he has to go and use his boss's Scotty's computer to look up the status of Maurice. He was very interested to see what they had for him, of course, and we find out that it was mentioned that he died of accidental causes, which of course is great news. You know, Ray was very happy to see that. We have this a wonderful moment where, of course, they're talking about Nikki's ass, which apparently Scotty seems to be like to call it the nutcracker caboose, which I don't know if I'm ever familiar with that term when it comes to a woman's backside. But, you know, hey, he really did want a piece of that, which you could tell Ray was a little bit annoyed by this conversation because, you know, he is talking about the girl he's with. But I don't know, obviously his boss doesn't know that, but it was a great moment. But no, the part I was a little confused about was, what exactly was he trying to say what happened with his computer? Something about vermin?
So he said that vermin, which is, you know, another way of saying like mice, rats, what have you. He said that they chewed through
his...
Yeah, that's what I believe. That's what he said, chewed through his computer cord. The question is, was he sincere or not? I mean, you would think so, right? Because otherwise he just looked things up on his own computer. I don't think, unless he was doing something screwy in his boss's computer, maybe he was planning to, and then this is just me thinking out loud, maybe he was pretending he purposely sabotaged his computer cords to go into his boss's office to, like, have the admin access to change Maurice's cause of death, if need be, to accidental. Okay. But once he found out he needed to do that, that didn't need to be the case. That's just me throwing a theory out there. It will not land as well as my sci-fi Ennis prediction, but that could be one possible thing he wanted to do.
Yeah, maybe some of our listeners, they have some theories as well they can throw in there, because I did a little research trying to find somebody talking about it, and I didn't really see a lot of conversation about it. I didn't realize that's what he was talking about when he said vermin. You're right, I have heard that term before. But, you know, you just had that scene where you could see him. He had the wire. It looked like the monitor wire, it looked like to me. And they had the shot down on it. And I felt like I was definitely missing something. But I do like this theory that you're right. He probably doesn't have the same access that his boss would have. Mm-hmm. So this theory does, to me, hold the most. It makes the most sense as well. But, yeah, if any of the listeners have some more thought on that, that's fine. But, you know, I just thought I would throw that back because I needed some help there, Mike, and I appreciate you helping me.
Happy
with
to help
that.
Out in any way, but don't you dare start talking about my own nutcracker caboose. That is not for you to check out, sir.
No, you know what? I'm going to leave that to your wife, sir. She can talk about your nutcracker caboose. I'm going to leave that alone, okay?
Sounds good.
You don't talk about my nutcracker caboose, and I won't talk about yours. That will be
Sounds
a
like
deal
a fair,
we're going to make right
deal
here on the podcast.
To me. Yeah.
Well, when Ray, of course, visits Nikki, she is immediately talking about a potential sponsor, Bert. Is it Lertzman? Something like that? I don't even know if I wrote it down right in my notes. But, of course, Ray is more concerned about their situation. She is more focused on this. Then we have this great moment where she slaps the hell out of him because she feels like his chi, his energy flow is all blocked up. That scene where she slaps him was just great. He's like, what are you doing? And then when she explains it to him, of course, you could tell the look on his face. He still had no idea what she's talking about, but he was like, oh, okay, yeah, yeah, maybe my energy isn't right.
Yeah, and then and this is perfectly representative of their relationship, right? She can just sort of make up any sort of mumbo jumbo and he'll believe it. But Nikki has such a fantastic way with words, even outside of the bad she thing. She talks about, you know, Maurice's death being misadventure due to major appliance or unfathomable pinheadery, which I think is the only time I've ever heard that term. So I feel like the writing for Nikki in particular is top-notch and really just shows how she's able to really BS her way out of any situation, particularly with someone who has such an affinity for her as Ray does.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, they come up with this plan, which, you know, we find out later on that clearly the two of them are not necessarily on the same page, but she thinks that they're on the same page as far as how to clear his energy by going back after the stamp. But one of the things I was kind of picking up was, like you said, is that her power influence over him is so strong. And I don't know if we talked a little bit of, I'm sure we did a little bit about this when we talked about episode one, but the parallels between her and Sai being able to influence the two brothers is just eerily. So the similarities there is so perfect. I think it's because of the fact that both of them, even though the brothers are very different in a lot of ways, but I think they are easily influenced by the people around him. In this case, of course, Nikki, and then for Emmett, it would be Sai. Do you feel like that? We talk about those comparisons. I can't remember.
No, we didn't talk about them in the first episode because, again, we didn't really see. We saw Emmett and Sai. We sort of talked about it last episode that they were completing each other's sentences. They definitely seem more like partners. Whereas I think we got to see a little bit more sympathy from Emmett's side this episode. Last episode, I think we saw a lot from Ray. This episode, we saw a lot more from Emmett than we did from Ray, and it's clear that Emmett is showing some remorse. And I think, yeah, because these brothers have such a familial connection, I think they're less likely to sour on each other. It's when you get these external opinions that you really start to get an idea in your head, and as a result, you might do things that you'll later regret. So yeah, as I mentioned before, I think we see more of Sai manipulating Emmett this episode than the first one. With Nikki, it's definitely par for the course, even though, you know, I think she reveals how, even though she has a way with words, Ray has the propensity to say things that might, you know, ruin the mood, in a manner of speaking.
Right. I think you're right. I think that's right, because it's a little more glaringly obvious in this particular episode when it comes to the two sides part of it, because Nikki was very obvious right off from the bat. But in this one, because we got to see so much more of Sai and his, the way he kind of influenced everything of Emmett's decisions. And we'll, even after, of course, this next scene where we get probably the scene most people are going to be talking about, when Ray shows up at Emmett's house at 10:30 at night. Poor Emmett, he thought maybe somebody had died or something terrible had happened because he just showed up at his house. But the whole thing was this ploy, of course, to distract Emmett as Nikki, of course, sneaks in to get the stamp. Of course, she doesn't find the stamp. She finds a replacement of a photograph or a image of a donkey, which she immediately thinks that, oh, he's messing with us. And as she finds it locked away in his drawer, a receipt for a safety deposit box. So immediately, of course, she's thinking he's messing with us. He's hidden the stamp. He doesn't trust Ray. You know, she's coming to, you know, assumptions. And she decides, of course, to leave him a very special message, which was quite gross, I might say. But yeah, it was just, I'm sure it was probably the scene that everybody was talking about. But again, this scene, it shows us again on how far goes. So many times where assuming something without knowing for sure can cause even more problems, which it does. And it really affects the relationship between Ray and Emmett, because the two of them are sharing this wonderful moment where they're smiling and they seem like they generally like each other all of a sudden. And it's all destroyed because of her interpretation about what is going on in this office. And now it's kind of, it looks like it's really going to probably damage their relationship forever now. Things with the brothers is not going to continue to go well here from here out. And it could have gotten better right there.
Yeah, and I think that you hit the nail on the head in that I think Fargo can be all about misunderstandings, even though the first episode is usually the
Right.
time when, like, dominoes fall in a weird way where a bunch of murders occur and people end up in the wrong place at the wrong time, as you mentioned before. But this is another indicator of that, right? Where Nikki comes in, totally misinterprets. Emmett's going to say later on that, you know, he got the picture of the stamp taken out to be framed, and that's why he just, like, put a placeholder picture of a donkey. But Nikki interprets that to say that he's toying with them. So as a result, she takes things to its quite literally bloody conclusion. We talked a little bit last episode about how Fargo sometimes does not show the more gruesome things on screen. This is sort of like a mixture of both, right? We didn't actually see the extraction in process when she pulled down her pants. I thought she might be doing other
Right.
things on the safety deposit slip, but
Me
to see
too. I
that
thought
happen,
maybe.
go ahead.
No, I was gonna say I thought maybe we might see a Duck Phillips kind of thing where she,
Yeah.
where he, when he left a nice little spoiler alert for people who haven't watched Man-Bit yet, but where Duck Phillips leaves a nice little gift for I believe it was in Roger's office, but maybe it was I can't
Yeah.
remember. I think it was Roger's office. But anyway,
Yeah.
yeah. So yeah, she starts to pull down her pants, but yeah, you don't see extraction, but we do get to see what was left behind.
Yeah, and I know that we'd received a message from KX about Nikki being on her period in particular. I will not go into it because it's a little NSFW, but we are, as always, appreciative of the feedback. I mean, I'll admit that when she had talked about being on her period to Ray the scene before, I thought it was sort of just a character thing. I didn't think it would actually pay
Right.
off like it did the next episode, but it's very clear that this is sort of like the dueling glove proverbial slap in Emmett's face to say it's on.
Yeah, exactly. It was great. It did really pay off very well, and definitely quite a gross moment, but it was great. I really enjoyed it. Now, you mentioned it a little bit. We mentioned a little bit earlier, but poor. Wow, you knew he wasn't gonna be on the show for long, but he has a run-in with the Vargas guys, his henchmen, and we get to learn the name. Well, in this particular scene, we get to learn the name of one of them. Eventually, we learn the name of both of them. But the name now, is it Yura Gurik,
It's
something like that, right?
Yuri Gurka, which, for
Gurka.
those of you eagle-eared listeners, might remember the first scene from last episode where we were saying, will this have any relevance? The answer is yes, because Yuri Gurka was the man who had been accused of strangling his wife in East Berlin in 1988, that man was wrongly accused of doing. So I guess the big question is, now we see someone named Yuri Gurka is working for Varga at this point. Do we think that this is the same Yuri Gurka? He escaped East Berlin, maybe ran into Varga whether in the UK or wherever Varga was traveling. It seems he's very well traveled at this point. They made their way over here. Now
Right.
he's working on behalf of his company.
Yeah, and the people were doing the math because there was mentioned that his age was 20, so this would put him in his early 40s in 2010. And you look at him. I mean, yeah, he could be that old. So I mean, it's very possible it is the same guy, or it's just Noah Hawley's way of messing with us and just thinks it's funny to have common names because you know we had the mix up with names with the Stussy. You know, maybe this is the same kind of theory is that, yeah, I'm going to give him the same name, but it's actually not the same guy. But I mean, it'll be interesting to see how that pays off. But yeah, it is definitely the same name, and it could very well be. And I could go either way. I'm okay with if it is him or if it's not him, but I think it'd make more interesting if it really is the same guy, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, they futz with age before. I won't go into a particular twist in the season two finale that might have opened some doors as to where a character from season two would appear in season one that I know drove a former cohort of ours crazy with the actual implications behind it. But it would be super
Right.
interesting because, again, last episode we were thinking, like, how the hell is this going to connect? And we were saying, okay, this doesn't connect, it's more thematic. But no, it actually turns out there might be a quite literal connection. And the other interesting guy is the other henchman who is this very silent man who keeps earbuds in the entire time. I guess he's always listening to music, but this is another trope that exists within the Fargo universe. You know, first season, we had Mr. Numbers and Mr. Wrench. Second season, we had the Kitchen Brothers who were both silent. It seems like the silent henchman is a well-worn trope in the Fargo verse.
It is. Yes, absolutely it is. And that's exactly what I wrote down too. Is like, oh, this is our new Mr. Numbers and Mr. Wrench, which still to me, by the way, is my favorite henchman. I can't imagine, and I don't again, I'm not going to spoil season one, but they're great. Mr. Numbers and Mr. Wrench was so fantastic. They still are my favorite, but we'll see how these two, you know, I love that moment when after they throw Perv off the edge, how they kind of, was it a fist pump or they high five? What they did? It was just, I did enjoy that. The two of them could give us some great comedic value into their henchmanness that they're going to be performing throughout the season, I'm sure. So we'll give them a chance, but you know, they have a lot to live up to in this silent trope that you said about these henchmen that we all love to see what kind of craziness they're going to do.
The one thing that differs from them is, you know, maybe they're sort of combining the elements from Numbers and Wrench and the Kitchen Brothers, and that the Kitchen Brothers, if you remember from season two, they were sort of the backup squad for Mike Milligan, who seemed sort of like Varga to be very well-spoken, very smooth, whereas Numbers and Wrench, I believe they were working on behalf of, I think it was Fargo, and so they were, but they didn't have, like, a boss that they were reporting to, unlike the Kitchen Brothers. So it seems like they might be taking the dynamic from the first season, but coupling it with the boss to report into from the second season.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I noticed a lot of people had mentioned the fact that they had Irv dressed very similar to Wade Gufferson, who was from the character from the movie Fargo, who was, of course, also killed in a parking garage. So nice little ties, more tie-ins that of course, is always fun to look at. He did look very similar to poor Wade, who met his untimely death by Donnie, who played that character.
It's a Steve Buscemi character.
Because he played Donnie. Yes, thank you, yeah. So there was this great little tie-in as well that we had. But of course, another death in Fargo. I'm sure we're going to have more. Neither one of us saw that one coming because we were not aware of their lawyer when we did our death draft.
Not aware of Irv nor his ineptitude when it comes to technology. So RIP Irv.
Right.
Hopefully in heaven, you're going to take some computer classes.
Yeah, he definitely needs them, that's for sure. Oh, boy. Well, so Nikki, of course, explains what she found in the office. They have their little meetup when she gets back into the car. Of course, Ray's very upset because, you know, there was a communication loss because it seems like he really thought maybe she wanted him to make up with him. And when she really meant, no, I think we should get the stamp. We should take the stamp. This scene is just more of showing that he is definitely not in control, obviously, of the situation whatsoever, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like Nikki is the one in charge, which makes things a little scary because, again, Nikki does not necessarily show herself to be the most adept character. Let's also, we didn't gloss over the fact that for an ex-con, you'd think she would know better than, you know, I don't see any gloves. It's clear that she showed signs of breaking and entering. Her prints are probably all over the place, and she's very clearly linked in the criminal database. If Emmett wanted to, he could easily send Nikki to jail and cripple Ray's strongest partner.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm not quite sure why necessarily wasn't something to think of, because the next scene, we do get to see Emmett and Cy discussing about what had happened. This is the moment, one of the big moments for me that we were talking about earlier about seeing more of Cy's side to be able to influence things that influence Ray so much is that he basically tells, I mean, to me, he's telling Ray, okay, it's time. You need to cut Ray out. I'll take care of this. You know, I'll handle the whole thing, but yeah, he's got to go. And that was the big takeaway I have of this scene where the two of them are discussing about what happens. And of course, then we also get the phone call when they learn about, you know, Irv being killed. But I don't know if there was anything else that you took away from it, but this was that really moment that was like glaring, like, wow, he really influences, you know, everything. It makes me wonder, like, how maybe all their decisions had ever been made. I wonder if Cy was pretty much the one that made the decision on what they were going to do.
Or at least making Emmett feel like he was making the decision when it was actually Cy. I mean, we'll talk later about the Cy-Ray scene. It seems like Cy completely went rogue and did that on his own. He didn't even tell Emmett that he was doing that.
Absolutely.
But But I'm going to make it a bold assumption here and say that, you know, Emmett is going to be concerned about the Varga stuff, which leaves Sai room to really go after Rey, which really makes things dangerous because, again, as you said, Sai is clearly the one out of the two to really hate Rey more. So I could totally see a situation where Emmett's so distracted by Varga closing in around him that he doesn't even notice the damage that Sai is going to be doing, whether from an automobile perspective or otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a scene with another very dense person at the, I guess he works at the morgue, where, of course, Gloria and Nathan are having a meeting with them to discuss about, burial arrangements for Innes. Obviously she tries to pry a little bit to find out if this particular person knows Thaddeus Mobley, which he does not. Just like Earl and Irv and some of these other characters, this poor worker at the morgue, he doesn't seem very bright.
did he call Ennis a horrible man? Did I hear that correctly? That was so strange. There's a difference between being dumb and being good at your job.
Yeah, that was a great part about the scene, was because he says this and they go, and he says something about, well, who's his next of kin? They're like, we're his next of kin. Oh. After you just got to basically calling this guy the worst human being ever, practically. And then it's like, oh, you're related to him. Oh, okay. I mean, he also puts his foot in his mouth about her mother when he said, why don't you ask her, his wife? And she's like, well, yeah, but she's dead. This guy loves putting his foot in his mouth.
Oh, yeah, 21J and Ash. Well, at least he's good at his job in that regard, in that he remembers his past clientele. And who knows how long ago Gloria's mother had died. But yeah, this guy was a little bit of an odd duck. I mean, maybe as the bodies pile up on Fargo Season 3, we'll see more of him. But yeah, it does seem like him and Earl and partly Donnie are like three examples of random characters, tertiary characters that flesh out this universe that are a couple of pumps short of a full gas tank. I'll keep it at that.
Yeah, absolutely. They're definitely missing a few sandwiches from their picnic basket, right? All right, so then the next, outside of, of course, the wonderful scene of Rey and Nikki's break-in to Emmett's house, this is another scene that everybody, I'm sure, was going to be talking about, is this meet-up with Sai and Rey at the restaurant. You know, that basically Sai informs him that, hey, we're cutting you off. I think he throws him $20, says this is the last money you're ever going to see from Emmett, from the parking lot king of Minnesota. They exchange birds with each other, giving each other bird. You know, we have this moment where the Christmas song starts playing in the background, and we see Sai just go completely rogue all over his quarry. He takes his takes his vehicle and just slams the hell out of this Corvette. Wow. And it's so reckless. That's why the first thing I wrote down was how reckless this was of Sai, because, and as we saw, when he peels away, he then hits one of the witnesses' cars as well. I mean, this is really not good, I thought. And you're absolutely right. There's no way Emmett knew that he was going to go to this level, right?
Yeah, and I think this is perfectly representative of the violence in Fargo as well. Ennis is a great example of this, where, you know, due to people take out their violence or try to take out their violence on each other, but there's almost always some innocent person that's in the crossfire that ends up going down as a result of whether it's a misunderstanding or whether it's petty infighting. And yeah, as Sai peels out, he ends up hitting another innocent person's car. I wonder, in terms of legal repercussions, that person has fault in order to, you know, put the blame onto Sai, maybe sue him. Maybe if Gloria starts investigating this whole snafu that comes with Ennis's death, they can say, okay, we now have a time and place where Sai was meeting with Rey Stussy, the suspect in question, and that's how things are connected. I feel like there's going to be a larger significance to that hit and run that we're going to see later on this season.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think there's going to be any kind of payoff from this? Because it just seemed really crazy that he would go that far. And again, my immediately reaction was going, yeah, this guy really, really hates Rey, like a lot. And another thing, too, I didn't think about this until just now, but, you know, that was a very nice, large, his vehicle, the
It was a Jeep, but it almost was like, it was like a Hummer, right? Or like Range Rover?
Hummer, yeah, that's what I was going to say. He had a very nice Hummer, and I was thinking to myself, you know, that's not a very inexpensive car. That's a very expensive car. So I have a feeling that, you know, I think Emmett takes care of him very, very well. I mean, he's definitely doing very well for himself because that's a very expensive car. Definitely worth probably more than that poor Corvette at this point.
Yeah.
That Corvette has seen better days that we mentioned.
The Ray's going to have to funnel some work and money into repairing his car, at least, and maybe that older woman's, depending on if she decides to, you know, seek his insurance information.
Yeah, exactly. But I this scene was great. I loved it. It was just fantastic. I love how when he peels away and he hits the car, he's like, oh, geez. We got one of the old G's, I was waiting for that. You know, I love that one. They say, oh, geez. But yeah, great scene. Again, Sai definitely MVP, like you said, in this episode. So many great moments with him that it was fantastic to watch. I really enjoyed it. And this scene really topped it off, right?
Absolutely. But then,
so let's talk about this final scene.
We get Sai briefly, but this is pretty much VM's tour de force. And he was only in one other scene, but I think he shows in this scene alone that he is there to play.
Yeah, he is. And I had wrote down how much I just love David's performance as VM. It's just so superb. Like, every word is so carefully crafted perfection, and just the way he does it, it's so slimy and perfect that I love this guy on screen. And I think we mentioned it in our previous show, and in the first episode it was a character that I was really excited to watch, and I'm just glad to see David's performance. He just nails us so great. So much comes out of this where he explains to these guys, you know, why. He really gives you a good feeling of why, of course, they decided with their business. I mean, they like we've already mentioned, how it's easy to hide because so much of it's cash involved. There's not a lot of technology. This is something that they can do. He explains that basically, you know, hey, again, this is, we're in business together. Whether you like it or not, you're trapped. I love the line where he kind of like explains that, you know, hey, we're at some point, you know, when all is said and done, you're going to be billionaires. Well, at least on paper. It was just great. There were so many great things that he said in this short moment in this scene that I'm falling more and more in love with this character.
Oh, well, watch out.
He admits to killing the lawyer.
Yeah. That's exactly what he wants you to do, though. He wants you to fall in love with him so then he can manipulate you, just what Nikki is doing with Ray. But yeah, he's going back to this car playing analogy. So she's so interesting in that he is directly showing his hand. Like we mentioned before, he says, you know, I picked Minnesota because it was boring and bland. It's clear that he sort of idealizes the nation states that exist in Russia and North Korea, which maybe are not the best populations for free choice, and I will leave it at that to not get too into the foreign policy of it all. But you know, he says that, as he mentioned, you know, the deal can't be changed, and yeah, you'll all be billionaires on paper. But then he totally makes this power play at the very end by saying, oh yes, it's a shame that, you know, your lawyer had to die, but we can't have people snooping around. And so he absolutely sends the message to the two of them of, you know, you snoop too close, no matter who you're affiliated with is going to go, and I could kill you at a moment's notice. And so he's absolutely showing that not only is he there to play, but he's there to make up the rules and run the entire game.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. And I'm sure as time goes on, we're going to learn more and more about him, and I can't wait to do that because dig into him. One of the things, by the way, he made a couple of off comments. One of the things he did, he actually spoke in French for a moment. And someone on Reddit did say that what he was saying in French basically was that he is a young imbecile or a dumbhead, which we could probably take basically call him a dumbass. And
he wasn't talking about Emmett's nutcracker butt?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think that was. But, you know, maybe he's a fan of his nutcracker butt. I have no idea. But I like the fact that he mentioned how Minnesota is so bland. And we had been talking so much podcast about the fact that a lot of the people, they portray the people in them kind of being a little dense, you know, easygoing, shall we say, maybe easily influenced and manipulated. Makes me wonder if that is basically what he was saying there. Is there's another reason why I'm here, guys, is because I feel like I could really bully you guys very easily. And I thought that's kind of what I got from that particular line about him calling mm-hmm. Minnesota bland. What did you think when he said that? Was that something that kind of you felt as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I think he was also describing something thematic that we've looped back about previously in the podcast. But I think, again, it's another power play for him to be like, I've been around the world. I've seen the best. I've seen the worst. One of the reasons why I picked this place is that it is boring. And it sort of shows he is putting himself on a pedestal above these characters by saying, I know more than you, and therefore I am better than you. And again, over these two episodes, he's really set himself up as somebody who does not play. He said, you know, we're going to play this game, but I have the ball. I make up the rules. I decide who hits. I decide when a point is scored. So as he vocalizes, Emin and Sai are pretty much trapped at this point. And have it that state be so declared early on, it'll be so interesting to see, are they going to be breaking out of it? How will they try to break out of it? Will it be at the cost of one of their lives? That's to be seen. But it seems like at this point, Varga is essentially unstoppable.
Yeah. Well, yep, I agree. Ooh, it's going to be good, man. I don't know what I am more excited about is learning about what's going on with VM or seeing what happens with the brothers. I mean, there's a lot going on, and that's what's great about Fargo is that they set all these great plot points that we have to look forward to see how they're going to play out, who's going to live, who's going to die. I really don't have to worry about updating their death draft, my friend, because our characters were not involved in killing anyone, and they all are still alive. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is that correct?
I believe so. Unless you kind of casualty as that poor old lady's car. That's maybe the only casualty. But yeah, in terms of actual human lives, nobody has killed. Nobody has died yet. But we shall see in future weeks. As I said, you know, outside of the more standout moments, it was a pretty run-of-the-mill, not really action-driven episode. Still a great episode, but it seems like from Varga's declaration, things are about to hit the fan very quickly.
Absolutely. It'll escalate as we go on and as the season goes on. So it's sometimes it's a slow burn, but that's okay. That's fine with me. I mean, I think anyone who's been invested with Fargo knows that that's how it goes. You're going to have those episodes like that where there's not a ton of action going on, but there's still great moments for us to talk about, you know, like the destruction of poor Ray's Corvette, or you know, Nikki leaving a very female hygiene weapon. And at one point was described as. So great stuff for us to talk about. Hopefully you guys enjoyed our breakdown of this. I don't like to touch on it too much, but I did see that the Nelson data numbers had come in for the season 3 premiere, which did grow about 3 million total viewers over 3 days, by the way. This is not the live numbers, putting it about 8% above the season 2 opener. And the reason why I kind of say that stuff, now it was down a little bit, by the way, on the key demographic, 18 to 49 demographic. I only kind of mention that at the beginning. I usually like to mention at the end of a season when we're recapping this, because I just kind of try to feel about like whether or not we think that, you know, Fargo would continue to get renewed, because I have not heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, no announcement yet from FedEx whether or not they will renew the Fargo franchise. Have you heard anything yet? Is this still up in the air with FX, or did I miss that news story?
Nothing as of yet, but I feel like FX is pretty good with some of its more banner franchises in terms of mm-hmm. renewing it. I mean, like, It's Always Sunny, for example, even though it moved to FXX, has never been the highest rated show, but it's going into its 12th or 13th season at this point. So I don't want to be too optimistic in case my hopes get let down, but I'd like to think, you know, I think that season 3 only being 2% below season 2 is pretty darn good, because I think season 2 was a good marked difference below season 1 for some reason. So I'm hoping that season 4 is catching on. It seems like FX likes Fargo. Fargo brings in a lot of critical acclaim, and they're getting a lot of notoriety for some of their more, you know, pinnacle shows like American Crime Story, American Horror Story, etc. So I have hope that Fargo's going to be back for season 4. And even if it isn't, it's too early, I think, to really indicate an automatic pickup. This is not Netflix we're talking about. This is an actual cable network. So we'll see how things handle from week to week. But I am reasonably confident that we will see a season four of Fargo. From then on, not entirely sure. It might depend on Noah Hawley. As we said, his time is divided. He's working on Legion as well, which got renewed for a second season. But if he wants to keep doing it, I think FX will keep letting him do it.
I agree. And it does. The climate of television is so different than it was even back when I first started podcasting in 2010, ironically, is that, you know, so much I don't think really relies on the Nielsen data anymore. I mean, it does, but it doesn't. I mean, it definitely, if you're a cable show or especially a network show, it still kind of has some relevance to it. But so many of the viewers nowadays hardly ever watch anything live anymore. I mean, it's really not what you need to look at. The look at is this 3-day overday look at is more important because that tells you, okay, they're not watching it live, but how quickly are they watching the episode? Are they watching it within a few days or are they waiting to not watch it? Now, we do have some good friends like our friend Antonio Mazzaro, who's immediately said he's planning on binge watching the show, which is perfectly fine because I think Fargo is a great show to binge. But yeah, the climate is so different. Television viewers consume television so differently. But I always I take a look, a quick glance, especially at the premiere, and then we'll see how it closes up. But I agree with you. I would be shocked if we don't have a season four of Fargo. And
so we're putting that out into the universe. No bad chi right here when it comes to Fargo season 3.
Yeah.
But in the 1/5 we've had of the season so far, the 20%, I've been enjoying it, and it seems like again they're really setting things up for a lot of conflict. Hopefully we get Gloria more incorporated into this main story moving forward, but I'm very excited to see where Fargo is going to take us, as always.
Yeah, absolutely. And sadly, that is the only story right now that I'm not nearly as invested in, but hopefully things are going to pick up with that, and we'll have more fantastic moments to talk about with the wonderful Karen Kuhn, which is I love watching her, of course, as we mentioned on the screen. So, Mike, unless you have anything else to say, I think that's pretty much wraps it up. And we will be, of course, back next week to talk about episode 3, right?
Yep. So a couple of housekeeping things. You can always reach out to us on social media if you want to let us know your thoughts on the episode as well as any other predictions or theories you may have. Jeremiah, you are at J Panhorse. Is that correct?
That is correct, my friend.
Perfect. And I am at @MikeBloomType, both on Twitter there. If you are not already, please subscribe to the Fargo with Jeremiah and Mike feed. And while you're there, please rate and review us. That is greatly appreciated. That's going to help us be viewed in the iTunes charts more and more. And obviously, as a new podcast, we want to make sure that we are viewed as much as possible. And thank you so much to the couple of reviewers who have already left us kind remarks in the previous week. We greatly appreciated that. While you're here, check out all the other great stuff on the Jay and Jack Network, doing coverage of The Leftovers, as was mentioned before, as well as Survivor, The Broadcast, The Merry Man Show. That's all there. You can subscribe to the Jay and Jack whole enchilada feed as well to really get a sense of everything that Jay and Jack does with all those fantastic individuals. If you are going to be in North Carolina next week for the big podcast meetup, I will be there in person recording a Leftovers podcast on Sunday. So I look forward to hopefully meeting some of you in person and talking a little bit of Fargo next weekend. And also with the Jay and Jack Network, make sure you are using our links for Amazon.com, jayandjack.com/Amazon. And make sure if you're not already and you want to talk some more, not only about Fargo, but a bunch of other TV shows in general and be able to communicate with the whole array of TV fans and all around great individuals, you can become a patron of Jay and Jack. Just search for them on Patreon. You get a bunch of additional benefits. And thank you so much to everyone who is a patron of the podcast so far. We greatly appreciate it. I think that's all that I have for now, but excited to be back as always with you, Jeremiah, next week talking Fargo.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to talk about it. It's going to be fantastic. And you're right. Definitely become a patron. I'm a patron myself because I definitely want to keep this content going on because there's so much wonderful things here on the Jay and Jack Network. And we appreciate everything that you listeners do to help support the show. So, yeah, Mike, in the next week, my friend, we will be back to talk about the 3rd episode. And so same bat time, same bat channel, right?
That sounds good to me.
All right, man. You take care, buddy.
You too.